right now on Nights, right-wing thinker, Eric Crampton. Sorry about that, Eric. It's Head of Research at the New Zealand Initiative. Kia ora, Eric.
Good evening.
Welcome back to Nights.
Oh, thank you.
You want to talk about growth, GDP growth. I assume you're talking about GDP growth.
That's the best measure of it that we have currently, yeah.
Just remind us of what GDP stands for again.
That's gross domestic product. It's the measure of the final value of goods and services produced in an economy that are for trade in any given year. So it's a measure of the flow of new stuff.
So everything that's bought and sold.
That's right.
Right. So it doesn't measure, for example, it wouldn't measure things that I might do for myself or anybody else might do. If, for example, I have a vegetable garden at home and I have a big crop of spuds, I had a reasonable crop this year, that's not going to get measured by GDP, is it?
No, it wouldn't be, but there are lots of things that wouldn't get counted either. Trade in the illegal sector doesn't get counted. What matters, though, if we're looking at economic growth, is so long as those sorts of things don't change that much from year to year, the growth in the value of traded things is a good measure of real economic activity changes.
Do we have to be careful when people say things are growing because GDP has increased? Say, in the example of the Christchurch rebuild, that people will talk about this is having an impact on GDP, but that's rebuilding something that got knocked down.
Sure. It would be a big mistake if you took a big insurance payment after your house burnt down and said that you were better off because your annual income that year included a big check from the insurance company and no house. GDP is a measure of flow, not of a stock, and you always want to be on the lookout for changes in those flows that might reflect a running down of capital stock. So it's a bit of an economic fallacy to think that natural disasters, for example, are good for the economy. They'll show up as a blip upwards in a GDP statistic, but they're still to the national debt.
So when somebody looks at that blip and says, look, our economy's going really well, you would say, be careful. You have to be careful about how you read the stats.
Well, you wouldn't say that the earthquake was good for the country at all. It's contributed to a lot more people working in Christchurch now on rebuilding-related things rather than working on other stuff, and more workers coming in from abroad to work on it. But that is very different from saying that the earthquake was good.
Given its limits then, why, however, do you still think it's the best measure of how an economy is doing?
Well, a lot of the problems with GDP wash out when you look at year-on-year changes. So whatever problems you had with GDP as a measure in the year 2000, they're the same problems that we've got with GDP as a measure in the year 2014, 2015. Changes in GDP year-on-year will reflect then the real changes. And those changes in GDP per capita year-on-year are associated with all the things that we really do care about, like improvements in life expectancy, health, education, reductions in child mortality rates, all kinds of good stuff.
Now, you said something per capita, because what you're really interested in here is how much the economy grows, not on its own, but per person. So if we had a population that grew by 5% and an economy that grew by 1%, we'd all be actually getting a little bit poorer on average. Is that right? Is my maths kind of right there?
If total GDP went up by only 1% with a 5% population growth, that wouldn't be very good at all.
No. So what is it about GDP per person that's so important? Why is it that growth, when we all get, on average, create more wealth, that's good?
Well, the per capita measure is a good measure of the strength of the overall economy, how much we're innovating, how much better we're getting at fulfilling others' needs, providing the goods and services that other people want, and how good we are getting at coming up with new recipes for turning raw materials and labor input into things that people value.
Are you a bit concerned in the New Zealand Initiative that we can sometimes get a bit averse to GDP and GDP growth? In the end, it's been GDP growth through industrialization in the West and now in parts of Asia, China and India that is the biggest factor in increasing our standard of living?
Oh, definitely. It's been the single greatest force for good over the last 100 years. It's pulled hundreds of millions of people out of desperate poverty and into reasonable lifestyles. There's still very real poverty in the world, but it's much less serious than it was even 50 years ago. The benefits of growth have been spreading out from the developed world into China, India, and now beyond. This is it's making people's lives a lot better. They're seeing fewer of their children dying in infancy and in early childhood. Grandparents are being able to see their grandkids. This is great.
somebody might argue, I'm imagining somebody saying, well, what about the importance, say, in terms of health in the West? Because I don't think we can talk about this maybe in the East and India or China so much, or the welfare state. What difference did that make to things like infant mortality? Did that have anything to do with GDP per capita?
Well, anything that pulls the bottom up, whether economic growth or some redistribution in the short term, will be good for health outcomes, I suppose, in that cohort. But what really matters over the longer term is economic growth, because otherwise you don't have the base from which that you can, from which you can support through income support mechanisms in the, with the state, transfer programs to help the poor. It would be short-term thinking to want to take a whole lot of money from richer cohorts, transfer it to the poorer cohorts now to improve some outcomes there without considering the effects on economic growth over the longer period and what we might be doing then to our grandchildren 50, 100 years from now.
So when you've been looking at growth, is it just across the world or in New Zealand?
Oh, both.
Recently? Over what time frame?
Well, the longest time frame you can look at would be the work that economist Robin Hanson over at George Mason University was doing, looking back 2 million years and looking at big technological transitions from development of better tools in the hunter-gatherer stages into agriculture and then over to the Industrial Revolution. Technological changes that affected real and substantial improvements in standard of living were few and far between, and it's only really in the last 200 years that we've been able to profit from it substantially. In prior eras, technological advancements would turn fairly quickly into larger family sizes, reducing the amount of food per person again after you've had a technological innovation that produced more food, and then you got back towards subsistence in what economists call the Malthusian trap, the era in which economic growth does not outpace population growth by enough to be able to be self-reinforcing. And that's only really picked up since 1820, and its growth skyrocketed since then.
Malthus, he was the guy that gave economics the gloomy science tag, wasn't it?
He's the one who's often credited for it, but that's not actually right. It was, instead, economists are called the dismal science because we opposed slavery in the Carlisle Mill debates. So,
really?
You were
dismal scientists for opposing slavery?
Exactly. In contrast to the gay sciences of poetry and literature, which Thomas Carlyle in Britain thought were more humane and recognized that other races weren't as good as white people in his view, and that we were condemning them to subhuman existence by not allowing them to be slaves.
But Malthus said, am I right in saying that he concluded that we were not going to be, back in the 19th century, we wouldn't keep up, we would run out of food and
that was
into hell in the handbasket.
Yeah, that was Malthus's iron law of wages, that he thought that population growth would forever outstrip productivity increases and that it'd always be eaten away by increased birth rates among the poorest, and that would then bring the per capita standards back down to where they were before.
Why did they get it so wrong?
He underestimated how technological innovation and economic growth could proceed. So it had two things going on. One, growth really picking up through the Industrial Revolution, and that also encouraging people to have smaller family sizes where you have more of a chance of your children making it through adulthood and beyond. You don't have as many children within a given family.
If we look at the 19th century and we look at changes in the West, industrialization, did we see more distribution, more wealth getting through to poorer people during industrialization or after trade unions and then liberal governments, say, in the late 19th century, maybe early 20th century, began to transfer some wealth to people at the bottom?
Well, I don't have distributional data on incomes from the 19th century, so I can't speak to that as much. You could compare poorer countries with stronger trade union movements, perhaps, and see whether poor people are better off in richer countries with less strong unions. But if we were looking within New Zealand since 1953, for example, real incomes among the poorer cohorts, say the bottom, not that the bottom 90% is poor, but just as an example of that, growth isn't confined to the top 10%. Incomes from 1953 through, I think it was about 2013, doubled for the bottom 90%, while they only went up by 50% for the top 10%. So for every dollar that somebody in the bottom 90% was making in 1953, 1993, that person would have been making $2 today in real terms, inflation adjusted, while somebody in the very top was only making $1.50.
Some person might say, you could say, well, that's because of the welfare state up to the mid-80s. After that, it all went downhill. I don't know if we can talk about that. But there is another thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is the limits to growth. If we acknowledge, and I think there is a strong case to say, because we can see it happening in developing parts of the world, that growth is getting people out of poverty. People who before relied on income, on the land, on even if it wasn't subsistence, they were still working in agriculture, now working in industry. But are there ecological limits to the GDP growth model? Can we keep on producing more and more? If everybody in the world had the same standard of living as you and me, could the world sustain it?
Sure. There are a few things going on in there. So first, there's the usual argument that economic growth is bad for the environment. That's being looked at fairly extensively by economists. We have what's called the environmental Kuznets curve. So we tend there to find that the kinds of bad environmental effects that come with early stages of economic growth that are noticeable at the local level reverse themselves fairly quickly once you get to a reasonable level. So once you reach sort of Chinese current GDP per capita figures, the environment starts mattering a lot more and people start voting, well, not voting in China, but putting pressure on the government for better environmental conditions. And we're seeing that now where smog in Beijing has become a more political issue. There's been more pressure there for improving environmental quality on the kinds of things that people notice. So that doesn't hit in quite as much on things people don't notice as much, like carbon dioxide, but on things like particulate matter where they do notice it, or sulfur dioxide emissions, there's reasonable evidence for a Kuznets curve. A second bit in there would be that people underestimate the potential for technological innovation. So it's not just that folks in the developing world will achieve our standard of living, it's that they would achieve that by being able to innovate and produce and having better economic and political institutions that would allow for it. And part and parcel with that is greater innovation also coming from the developing countries. So you're starting to see medical advances coming out of China and new drug technologies coming out of there that we wouldn't have imagined before. As you get more and more minds working on the problems of scarcity and problems of pollution, trying to figure out better ways of innovating, better machines, better technologies, then we'll see better pollution reduction there too.
In other words, you can't imagine the world with everything being made the way it is now, because if there were more people with more wealth, there'd be more investment going into, say, producing cars with some kind of material that doesn't need to be dug up out of the ground, or running those cars on something which is more sustainable, that doesn't rely on fossil fuel.
Now, when all of the countries in the world are rich enough to be able to afford a decent car, it's because they will be producing the ideas and the innovations that enable that sort of lifestyle, right? And that's also producing technological innovations to help mitigate problems.
Can we do that without factoring some price in, however, for carbon emissions? Because you hinted at that before. If we accept that global warming is something that humanity needs to address, or at least carbon and dioxide in the atmosphere, just focusing on GDP without some kind of price for carbon emissions isn't sufficient, is it?
Well, there's a decent case in general for putting prices on environmental disamenities, so effluent, including carbon dioxide. There's a reasonable economic case for things like carbon taxes. At the same time, we need to weigh that off against whether there are substantial detrimental effects on economic growth and whether carbon taxes work better than some of the technological pushes that have been coming out of the States around solar. I'm reasonably convinced around carbon taxes, but it's, and especially on the kind of insurance argument where you might want to spend a little bit more than something might be worth to avoid potential catastrophes. But we're getting close to the point now where solar is getting to be cost-effective, that solar in the States in a lot of places is economical for homeowners to put up. As those costs continue to come down, a lot of this problem will solve itself.
Eric, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
Eric Crampton from the New Zealand Initiative, back with another look from the right in a couple of months.